Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And away we go. Hour two of the Patrick Madrid Show is starting right now. And if you've been thinking about calling, you want to get on the air with a question, a comment, you need a second opinion, it's Taco Tuesday and you want to celebrate, give me a call. The number is 888-914-9149. I have space available right now, 888-914-9149. Let's start with Cody in Albuquerque. Good morning, Cody.
Morning, Patrick. How's it going? So you've been talking for the better part of the hour about children and smartphones, porn addiction, and various other things. And it makes me curious because, you speak so well of your children, your 11 kids, not to put you on the spot by any means. But I'm curious, when they were growing up, did you let them have, I guess, really, what is the right age to let kids have access to video games? When should they be allowed in the home and various other things? I grew up with, I can't see, so I can't play them, but I grew up with around Game Boys, PlayStations, and various other things. And did your children have access to those things at all? And secondly, I guess I hear a lot about smartphones and various other things, but what sorts of music standards did you have in the Rancho Madrid? Because I was never a television watcher. I'm a music lover. So,
yeah, I hear you.
If you don't mind sharing some of those things.
No, I don't mind a bit. I don't mind a bit. So usually whenever I'm talking about stuff, you know, family-wise or my kids, I usually am somewhat vague only because I want to respect their privacy. They're all adults now. And, you know, I just want to be respectful of their own privacy. But I can speak in general terms. Sure, that's no problem. So as far as video games are concerned, that started in Rancho Madrid in the, what would it have been, early-ish 1990s. And it was, so we never had an Atari, we never had an Activision. Those are kind of fun, but primitive. I think the first game system we ever bought the kids was a Sega system. And the only game I really remember them playing the heck out of was the Jurassic Park game. So if you can date it, I think that would have been sometime in the early 90s. So our oldest son, who's going to be 42 this year, he would have been an adolescent. He would have been like, you know, 12 or something like that. So that's really when it started. And it was, as I recall, it was Sega, and we would update the system every so often. And they would play the games, and it was a lot of fun. But the difference is, in those days, of course, there was no internet the way we know it today, and we didn't even know the internet was coming in those days. So there was no internet connectivity. They couldn't get out through the game onto the internet the way you can now. So as our kids got older, and those kids grew up and became young adults, the ones who were the youngest kids, they had I don't remember now if it was... We had a Game Boy, the hand console. We had that for many years. We had they moved on from Sega to whatever the next thing is. What would it be? I'm so out of that loop. I don't really know.
I don't know. I'm 31 years old. I've never heard of a Sega in my life.
Oh, well, go to a museum sometime, young man. No, I'm just kidding. No, back in the olden days, that was a game platform, Sega, S-E-G-A. So then I guess it went to whatever the other ones are. My mind is blanking. I don't remember the names. Whatever you play Call of Duty on or whatever you play those games on, they had those. But it wasn't internet connected. And we would always be really careful about what games that we let them play. But as they got older, I mean, they understood kind of what was expected. Now, as far as music is concerned, we've always been a very musical family in terms of listening to lots and lots of music. So when our older kids were young, they heard a lot of the kind of music that Nancy and I like. So they heard a lot of the Beatles. They heard Chicago. They heard the Cars. They heard, you know, just lots of the music that was interesting and important to us when we were young marrieds, because we listened to music all the time. That's also when MTV came out in the early 80s. And back in those days, MTV was pretty cool because all it did was really just show music videos, and you could kind of get to know the bands that you heard the songs on the radio from, and that really took off. So a lot of Duran Duran and assorted things. So they grew up with that. And it, looking back on it, Cody, I think it shaped their musical tastes. Not that that's like all they listen to. They listen to all kinds of modern music. But I think it helped them to gravitate toward music that's more melodic and worthy. I don't really remember any of our kids ever going through a rap phase or a hip hop phase or anything. It just wasn't the kind of music that they were raised with. So in a nutshell, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I can sadly say that I did go through a hip hop phase, and I, you know, I wasn't yet Catholic, but my mother begrudgingly let me listen to it. And I learned the, you know, I mean, I eventually learned how bad that stuff really was. So
my objection is that it is, to me, this is just me. I know some people really dig it, but to me, it's like the music of anarchy and rebellion. And especially when it gets juiced up with lyrics about killing cops and stuff I can't even mention on the air about women. And violence. I mean, why listen to that? I mean, even if the beat is good, and granted, some of them are really catchy, no doubt, but the words where you know, I part company there, I don't want to hear that.
Yeah, there you go. Wonderful.
Cody, last time we talked, which is probably about a year ago, I think you had a lady friend you were interested in pursuing for marriage. How did that
end up? Oh, my Lord,
I
can't believe you remember this.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Oh my gosh. You have 24 hours? No. No, that's no
Give me the
case.
30-second made for radio version.
I aided and abetted in deceit. I'll put it that way. And I'm also at a stage in my life where I have multiple disabilities, and I'm not able to, I don't think I'll be able to ever have children. I cannot successfully take care of a child. I don't have the hands-on skills to do so. And so I'm trying to, you know, now I'm at a stage to figure out, is marriage even possible for me?
I see. So, yeah. You know. But that relationship, we talked about that a few times, and it was, there were some troubling aspects in your mind. And so I guess I'm being nosy. Forgive me for that. But since we talked about it before, have you moved on beyond that relationship?
Yes. Like I said, I aided and abetted in things that weren't good. And so, yes, I did move on from that. And I haven't.
Got it. Got it.
Well,
you have my full faith and confidence. And when I told you a year ago, and even before that, when you called before, I told you I would pray for you. And I have been praying for you ever since.
Well, your prayer has helped. I honestly cannot believe you remember this out of all the thousands of calls you take every day. So I appreciate it so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Well, chin up. And, you know, press on in confidence and hope and all those good things that God tells you. It's going to be good, and it's going to get really good when you go to heaven. So live for heaven right now. We all should do that, right? Thanks for the call. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Angela in California. Good morning, Angela.
Hello. Good morning. I just, when you talk about heaven or what do you call it? You call it the checklist. What do you say before the checklist?
The exit interview. That's what I call it.
Exit. Yes. Yeah. So the exit interview, I think it's kind of too mild. I think we should approach death with fear and trembling, because God knows our thoughts, our actions. He doesn't need a checklist. He doesn't need to ask us. And I know you're just making an analogy, but it's people should approach it with fear. He knows our every thought, our every deed, and more than what we tell people to do, what we did in our lives, he's going to judge us. And it's going to be either heaven or hell, or purgatory. But I think we should, saying a checklist, the exit interview, you know, it's cute, but I think people should be more fearful, approach fear, with fear and trembling. We're so
Angela, you're raining on my parade. I'm sad now.
Sorry.
Well, I get it. Well, I have to say the same thing in the same spirit. Sorry. No, I call it the exit interview because that's what it's going to be. As it says in Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. And that will be the time when your whole life is reviewed. So I approach it somewhat differently, Angela. Yes, fear and trembling, the Bible says that. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, the Bible says that. And so I don't disagree with the point you're making, but I would put it this way. If you love God with all your heart, mind, and strength, and you love your neighbor as yourself, and you're seeking by God's grace to do those things that the Lord is asking of you, then it shouldn't be fear-based. It should be love-based. And one of the things I've learned from the great saints is that they did pay due attention to the fearful consequences of those who disobey, as St. Paul talks about in Romans chapter 2. You know, you disobey the truth and you obey wickedness, then God's wrath will come upon you, and that's going to be a terrible thing. But for those who love God, like St. Paul, think about all the times that St. Paul, he talks about, I have fought the good fight, I have run the race, you know, and he's reaching out toward the time of his, at the end of his life. He talks about how his life is being poured out like a libation, and he's yearning to be with God, and there's a sense of joy and anticipation and happiness, not fear. So although I do grant the point you're making, I would add to that, that for you and for everyone else who is genuinely seeking the Lord by his grace, that as St. Paul says, perfect love casts out all fear. And so if you are on that path toward perfect love, then that takes the front seat, not the back seat. And fear should take the back seat, not the front seat. I'll leave you with the last word, though, Angela. That's my take on this.
Well, that's very kind of you to leave me the last word. But people who love God, Patrick, commit adultery. People who love God look at pornography. People who love God, we are all sinners.
Not all of them, though. Not all of them.
Pardon me?
Not all people who love God do that. People who struggle in their love for God do. And, you know, we all struggle in our own way, but there are people who love God and who don't do those things.
I don't know. Maybe you know people who don't commit any sins, but I think we are all sinners, and we should all be afraid of, you know, no one is so perfect, even the saints weren't. So that I think we should have fear. I mean, I disagree with you. You're great and all that. But just saying I love God and watching pornography, as you were talking about for a whole hour earlier, or just saying I love God and having affairs.
But I'm not saying that, though, Angela. Let's be fair. I'm not saying that, nor have I said that. What I'm saying is that there are people who struggle with their love for God and falling into sin. Thank God we have the sacraments to help us get out of that. But there are people, I know some people, I think I have a moral certitude at least, people who are genuinely free from falling into mortal sin. They just don't fall into mortal sin. And if I can give you some evidence-based reading, read The Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila. She's a master of the spiritual life. And she talks about the different stages of the spiritual life. And after you move through the first three stages or so, the souls who move in that direction no longer fall into mortal sin ever. They just don't, because they have progressed beyond that. And those who continue progressing, the idea of falling into mortal sin is so abhorrent to them that even though they're still sinners, we all are still sinners, they've moved beyond that time of struggling and falling and getting back up again. So there are indeed people who are like that. So fear is the beginning of wisdom, the fear of God is, but if it's just fear first, that's not what Jesus came to give us. He came to give us hope and joy and encouragement, and that's why I emphasize those things. Now, I promise this time I really will give you the last word. Go ahead.
Well, I love the Lord. I don't fear the Lord. But I fear living in mortal sin. And I think when we reach a St. Teresa's level, then we have a right to speak like that. But all of us, especially in this world, with all the temptation and all the crud going on in this world, there's a lot of temptation around. So I think we all sinners and have come short of being what God wants us to be. So I think just saying we're going to have a checklist, I think we should be afraid for live a life according to what God wants us to live. Yes, we will fail. Thank God we have confession. But I think you misunderstand what I'm saying. But anyway, I just wanted to make that point. Also, I went to Catholic schools years ago, and the nuns were absolutely wonderful. I think it started changing when they stopped wearing the habit. They were just terrific. They would never tell us not to bow before the altar. So unfortunately, you had a bad encounter. But
well, that was my kids, not me. I had great nuns when I was growing up too. Thank God.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, thank you for taking so much time with me, and I hope we see each other in heaven.
Oh, I hope so too, Angela. I'll look you up. If you get there before I do, say some prayers for me, and I'll do the same if I get there before you do. And I'm not looking forward to the particular judgment, but I have a lot of hope and a lot of happiness when I think about what awaits us in the life to come. Thanks, Angela. Great talking to you, as ever. We'll take a break and we'll come right back. The number is 888-914-9149. When we come back, I'm going to tell you what the latest song, it's not a song from nowadays, it's from back in the day. But the transgender activists hate this song. They hate it. And I'm going to play it for you. We've played it before on this program. I'm going to play it again. We're going to blast that song in their honor right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester, an Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro tacos. Don't forget the rice and beans on the plato. I like to eat, homie, yo no estoy flaco. Yeah, I'm chubby, pero I'm still guapo.
Patrick Madrid is on
Taco Tuesday.
Coast to coast on Relevant Radio.
Taco Tuesday's my favorite day. Favorite. That's the reason why I'm on our way. Better I don't care, homie, let them hate. I'm just trying to eat another plate.
I'm like a child. I derive so much pleasure from this silly song. And so many other people do too.
I love it.
It's great. I can just picture all the, all the listeners out there swaying to the music.
Oh, yeah. That was it.
That was it.
That got me that time.
Yeah, you weren't expecting that. Yeah, Happy Taco Tuesday.
Wow, Happy Taco Tuesday.
John wrote me a note. John is listening on the internet, and this is about the movie I recommended earlier starring Jack Lemmon, Days of Wine and Roses. He says, Patrick, this film is an invaluable resource for those who face the ravages of alcoholism and a cautionary tale for those who do not. I agree with you, John, 100%. And one more time, if you didn't hear me talking about this earlier in the program, talking about porn addiction in the first hour, and this guy was talking, the gentleman who called in, he was talking about how he, from the time he was 7, he had a porn addiction. 7! I was exposed to porn for the first time when I was 11. I think I've told you that story before. Terrible, terrible. The neighbor across the street, I'm out in the front yard watering. I grew up in Southern California. In the neighborhood, I'm out in the front yard watering the front lawn with a garden hose, because that was my chore that afternoon. So this kind of hippie bohemian long hair guy comes over. He lived across the street, he and his wife, and I think they had a little girl. And he, you know, he discos over to my yard and he says, hey, we're going to be going on vacation for a couple of weeks and we need somebody to feed the cats and the fish and whatever else, you know, water the plants. And, you know, I'll pay you $20 if you'll do that, if you want. I mean, if you want the job. And I said, really? $20? Like, to me, that was like $1 million. So I said, let me go ask my dad. So I went in, my dad's in the house, and I say, hey, Dad, you know, Mr. So-and-so across the street, he said he'll pay me $20 if I feed the fish and the cats and water the plants while he's gone. Can I do it? And he says, yeah. So I went back out. He's still there. And so he hands me the key to the house, and he says, here's the key. Come on over, you know, and I'll show you where the mealworms are for the – they might even have had lizards now that I think about it. But he says, I'll show you how to do it. So went in there. Showed me where everything was, the cat food and all that kind of stuff. So then they went on vacation. And there I was, Mr. 11-year-old innocent kid. And what did I find? I found that that house was filled with pornographic magazines. Everywhere. This guy had boxes and boxes of porn magazines all around that house. So I'll just put it this way. I was really diligent, really diligent. I never missed a beat. I went over and fed those cats and I fed those goldfish and lizards or whatever else was in there. And I watered those plants. And I think you can imagine what that must have been like for little old me. It was not good. And to this day, I rue the day that that man walked over and asked me if I would water the plants while he was gone. Shame on him. You know, God have mercy on him. So do I know from experience what it's like to be exposed at a young age to pornography? Yes, I do. So I'm not just talking theoretically here. I know because I was that kid once, and I don't want it to happen to your kid. So the man who called up and said that he was 7 years old when it happened to him and how it has wreaked havoc on his relationships such that his sister won't even talk to him anymore because she blames him because he did it and therefore she started doing it and what a mess that must have been. My whole point is that movie, Days of Wine and Roses, but starring Jack Lemmon, is it's that story about somebody who has a problem. And well, I don't want to tell you the plot, but I do want to tell you, watch this movie. What's the name of the lady? I'm trying to remember her name. It wasn't Vivian Leigh. Whatever it was, she was a beautiful young woman, never touched a drop of alcohol. This guy was an alcoholic, but he was kind of a fun alcoholic, you know, fun, the kind of guy you'd want to hang out with. And he was into like the three martini lunches and all that. And she was this beautiful, demure, innocent young woman. And it just, you got to see this movie to see what happens. And the ending is incredible. And yes, you can watch this with your older children. You could watch this with the middle school age child and above. Certainly you could watch it with high schoolers. I wouldn't let little kids watch it. But there are no bad scenes. There's no bad language. It's not that kind of a movie. But the subject matter about alcoholism is extremely powerful. So that's it. So thank you, John. I appreciate that. Back to the phones here. Let's get over to Denise in St. John, Indiana. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning, Patrick. I always seem to call you on Taco Tuesday, but happy Taco Tuesday. Oh, my God.
What better day to talk than Taco Tuesday?
Especially with the last song. I'm glad you didn't call me right away because I would have been laughing. But anyway, as a fourth grade teacher of religious ed, you know, I try to get ahead of questions they may ask or their parents may ask me. Mm-hmm. And this has been on my mind for a long time. Now, when the Pharisees and all these wonderful big shots from the temple would challenge Christ, and he and would point to the prophets, my favorite prophet, Isaiah, for example, how did they respond? I mean, did they try to twist the words so that Bethlehem and the virgin birth, you know, when you have all of these prophecies that have been fulfilled, how do you justify saying he was a blasphemer, he is not the Son of God? If someone says that to me, what do I say to them?
Well, there's a lot of by way of objections, rabbinic objections to Jesus, and one of the common arguments is that, well, Jesus didn't fulfill that prophecy, and he didn't fulfill that prophecy, and so forth. So, just to kind of cut to the chase here for you, I would recommend you get a book. The book is called "Refuting Rabbinic Objections to Christianity and Messianic Prophecies," written by a Jew who's converted to Christianity. His I think it's a pen name. It's Eitan Bar, E-I-T-A-N Bar, B-A-R. And what this book does is it cycles through all of, not only all of the prophecies pertaining to Jesus, like Isaiah 7:14, the virgin birth, Isaiah 53, the prophecy about Jesus being rejected as Messiah, Zechariah 12:10, him who they have pierced, they will look upon him whom they have pierced. Psalm 22, the prophecy about the crucified Messiah. Daniel 9, when will the Messiah come? Jeremiah 31, the new covenant prophecy. And all the others, you know, Bethlehem and all the other ones. And so if you're interested, and I guess you are, in what the objections are, you'll find them in this book, but you'll also find cogent and, I think, extremely persuasive responses to all of those objections. So if you want to get right down to the nitty-gritty, that's what I'd recommend. I found that book very helpful in my own
And can you tell me again? I think the author was, his last name is B-A-R-R?
No, B-A-R, Eitan Bar, E-I-T-A-N, Bar.
Okay,
I think it's a pseudonym. I don't know. Bar is Hebrew for son of. But in any case, the book is called Refuting Rabbinic Objections to Christianity and Messianic Prophecies.
Okay, got that down. And real quick, I just wanted to tell you something beautiful about our new pastor. The first Sunday he said Mass, we were like in shock, not shock, but we were just so happy. Twice during the Mass, he, at the end of, like the list of prayers and at the very end of the Mass as well, he always says, we all say Hail Mary together. He sort of closes his eyes and puts his head down and says, and for all the victims of clergy abuse. The first time he said that, the whole church applauded. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. So twice during Mass, he prays for the, and he also mentioned, which we sort of, laughed at, but he said he was almost fearful that if he ever saw it happening, that his anger would overtake him and he would probably beat the guy up. I mean, and that's the kind of, he's just so angry about that, but it's just such a beautiful thing to see twice on Sunday, we pray for them. So again, I can't say enough, a shout out to our Father Greg. And that's all I wanted to say for today.
I bet he likes that. Thanks, Denise. Kind of you. Appreciate that. Let's go to Richard now in Rancho Cucamonga, California. I know that town, right off the 10 freeway. Welcome.
I know you do, Patrick. So I have a question for you. So a friend of mine who is a hardcore Protestant Calvary Chapel guy sends me links all the time about how the Catholic Church is worshiping Satan and the Pope is the Antichrist, blah 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 blah, and a lot of it, the videos are from TikTok, and so I don't pay no attention to it, but so I pull out my heavy hitters and I post videos of Scott Hahn's conversion story. I send him the link to your show. If he has questions, call you, let you do the heavy hitting, because I'm not close to where I need to be. You're way better than I am.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. We're here to help. So is this a friend that you see like face to face, or is this somebody over the internet, or
no,
how do you know this guy?
No, he was not even a friend. He was just a person I went to high school with, and we do it straight through Facebook messaging. So it's not face to face or anything like that. So the recent video he sent me was, why do priests, bishops, cardinals, and Pope, why do they dress like wizards? They dress up like wizards. Why is that? Nobody questions it. And, and I laughed at it, So I went to Catholic Answers. And
is there like a standard issue wizard uniform that they're supposed to wear? Are like all wizards wearing certain All right. So you want a quick answer to that question? I can give it to you.
Okay. So real quick. So, you know, I went to Catholic Answers and I read up, you know, I know it goes back to the Old Testament and how, what they wear and everything like that. So if I could give him somebody, you know, a voice to, instead of me just trying to explain it to him, maybe you can explain it to me and I can send him the link to the show.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's not that difficult. I mean, it's not really a difficult question at all. And the information is readily available. So you mentioned Catholic Answers. You already know their website is Catholic.com. And they have the Catholic Encyclopedia from back, you know, 110 some odd years ago. They have that digitized at Catholic.com. So the first thing to do, and I don't have this in front of me, I'm not looking at it, but if you were to go to the alphabetized, you know, section for the articles, I'll bet if you clicked on V, you would find the article on vestments. So go down to vestments, mm-hmm. and it will give you, mm-hmm. and this, of course, would be pre-Vatican II, so it's going to list the vestments as they were worn by the priests prior to Vatican II. So it includes some of the vestments that are typically no longer worn, the maniple, for example. But in any case, that article is going to give you not only the biblical, but also the historical connections to the vestments. But simply put, in the beginning, in Jerusalem, in AD 33 and beyond, they didn't wear vestments. The priests, the bishops, they didn't wear vestments. They wore the clothing of the day. And the first Christians, of course, who were Jews, they wore typical Jewish attire. So they would have worn a prayer shawl. They would have worn the tzitzit, I think it's called, you know, the long fringes that come down from a tunic that they wear under their jacket. And this is where this is where Jesus, in excoriating the scribes and Pharisees in Matthew chapter 23, talks about how they like titles of honor and to be seen in public, and they lengthen their tassels. This is referring to those fringes that hang down from this tunic. So they would have worn that kind of attire. That's what the Jews wore in those days at that place. And then as time wore on, especially as the church began to take root in the heart of the Roman Empire in Rome itself, there were certain customs among the pagan Romans in terms of how they would dress. They would have certain signs of authority. And so over time, the church began to include some of these, not the pagan Roman things per se, but just recognizing that, especially during liturgical functions, the celebration of the Mass, etc., that it was appropriate to show the authority and the ministry of a priest or a bishop. This got to the point where in the early church, when the Emperor Constantine lifted the persecution ban against the church in the early 4th century, this is where you begin to see the Catholic Church building church buildings, you know, building basilicas. Not that they didn't exist before, but they were clandestine. So now out in the open, and typically you would see other stylized things like a chair that was placed in front of the altar in these early Catholic basilicas, and that's where the bishop would sit. He would sit in the chair and he would preach from the chair. It's actually a holdover from Matthew 23. Jesus invokes this Old Testament oral tradition when he says, pointing to the scribes and Pharisees, he says, they have taken their seat on the chair of Moses, the cathedra. Therefore, obey what they teach you, but don't follow their example, because they're hypocrites, blind guides, brood of vipers, etc. So we see this gradual inclusion of things like that, like the chair that the bishop would sit and preach from, teach from. Vestments and other accoutrements that gradually began to develop. And the reason they developed was because there was value in those signs and symbols of the priestly authority. So the vestments that the priests wear today are simply the modern version of what in the early church they began to adopt. Now, you're right about this, and that is that in the Old Testament era, there was a very meticulous pattern that was given by God to Moses for what kind of vestments the priest had to wear. They had a whole series of vestments, and the high priest especially. And so we can see the pattern that was given by God there. Ergo, there is nothing wrong. There's nothing inherently wrong with priests wearing vestments because God commanded it in the Old Testament. And you can certainly see the vestiges of this in the book of Exodus as well as Deuteronomy and Leviticus. So what's happening in the New Testament is, in light of Christ, that in this new priesthood that Jesus himself established, it is right and proper for these signs and symbols to be present as well. That's really all that is. So if you want to get some nitty-gritty, I think there's an article called Vestments in the Catholic Encyclopedia. Check that out first. If you want something more scholarly, you can get the book. It's actually a two-volume book, by Joseph Jungmann. It's called The Mass of the Roman Rite. And it's an historical detail of the development of the Mass of the Roman Rite, including such things as vestments. If you want a good overview of the kind of vestments that the Old Testament priesthood wore, and that was the obsolete priesthood that passed away because it couldn't actually do anything, it just symbolized what Jesus would do by his saving death on the cross, there's a book by Alfred Edersheim called The Temple. And it's a classic work in the field. I have two volumes of it in my library, one volume that has some illustrations, very helpful. And it'll give you a detailed accounting of what those vestments were. So all of this to say, your friend is barking up the wrong tree here. And chances are he's just mad about it because Catholics do it. And there's a Pavlovian response among many non-Catholic folk who just... they don't like it, and they oppose it because the Catholic Church does it. They're not even sure really why they oppose it other than that, but they do. So they're scrambling and searching and rummaging around, trying to find some way to argue against this Catholic thing, whatever it may be, without realizing the historical and biblical roots of that thing. So check that out. Lastly, if you want to go the extra mile, Carl Keating wrote a great book back in the day. It's called Catholicism and Fundamentalism: The Attack on quote-unquote Romanism by quote-unquote Bible Christians. And he has a number of chapters that deal with this very kind of argument. Oh, this is just pagan stuff that the Catholic Church latched onto. This is just what the pagans did. And he debunks all of those claims methodically and very decisively. Check that out. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
That's right. That's how we roll here on the Patrick Madrid Show. Taco Tuesday, as you might have guessed. So that song by Aretha Franklin is the one that the trans activists hate. I'm surprised it took them this long to get around to doing their 15 minutes of hate. Let's play the song. It's 1968, Aretha Franklin, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Let's hear it. They hate it. They hate it. You know why they hate it?
How can you hate this song?
It's a great song. We've been playing this song for a long time on the Patrick Madrid Show. Can you guess why they hate this song, Young Thomas?
You know, I've no idea. That is, it blows my mind. I was just jiving out to this while we're playing it. So
all right. So here is from a trans activist on Twitter who said, Aretha Franklin's 1968 song Natural Woman perpetuates multiple harmful anti-trans stereotypes. There is no such thing as a natural, and the word natural is in quote marks, there is no such thing as a natural woman. This song has helped inspire acts of harm against transgender women. TCMA is requesting it is removed from Spotify and Apple Music. That's the punchline to the whole thing. They are demanding... they're shocked that people would listen to this 1968 hit because of all of its harmful anti-trans stereotypes. Just shut up already, please. This is just so ridiculous. And the what's the right word? The essence of their objection is that there is no such thing as a natural woman. Of course there is. whoever you are, trans activist person, you were born from a natural woman. You weren't born from a man. We were on our marriage and family and faith enrichment cruise this past week, as you know. That's why I have a suntan. That's why I'm sporting a suntan right now in the middle of winter. And one of our group who might be listening right now, somehow it came up, I was talking, I said the word man, and from the audience, he or she said, "You mean Mayan," as I am wont to say at times. So yeah, you weren't born from a man, you were born from a woman. And if you stop and think about it, you were born from a woman because, how can I put this? Men don't have, I want to put this delicately. There's no exit. Is that the right way to put it? There's no exit for a baby to be born.
You know, that's
from a man.
It seems delicate.
Come on, Ben.
Maddie, where have you been?
Come on, man.
I know. I think that's delicate. That's sufficiently delicate. There's no exit from a man if you want to be born. And everybody's been born, and the trans activist people have been born, and they did not come from a man. They came from a woman. That's what a natural woman is.
Yeah, this is true.
This is the essence. Let me just read. This is from Jane Hertz. One alleged activist group in Norway is calling for Aretha Franklin's hit song, "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman," to be removed from Apple Music and Spotify because they deem its lyrics offensive. The Blah 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 Alliance took to Twitter last week to condemn the ballad, citing it that it has ignited harm against transgender women. By the way, there is no such thing as a transgender woman. I'm sorry, but there are men who dress up as women, and God forbid, they even go further and have terrible surgeries to mutilate their bodies to try to make them look more like women, but they're still men. The organization tweeted, "There is no such thing as a natural woman." They say that it has helped inspire acts of harm, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What else? The Blah, 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 Blah Alliance is calling for this hit to be condemned, rejected. And it just goes on in that vein here. And that's what I'm saying. The very idea that there could be an actual man or an actual woman is repugnant to them. So if there is no such thing as an actual man or an actual woman, then what are we left with? This mythical, imaginary, fairy tale construct that there really are no men and women. Well, and by the way, if there are really no men and women, then there is no such thing as misogyny. You can't be a misogynist, which means to be against women, if there are no such thing as women. You can't be a feminist if there's no such thing as women. There can't be anything known as patriarchy. There is no such thing as patriarchy. Look, we just abolished patriarchy with the stroke of a pen, or really the click of a key on a keyboard on Twitter. They've abolished the patriarchy. It doesn't exist because men don't exist. If there is no such thing as a natural woman, there is no such thing as a natural man. They're just things. Things with body parts. That thing, can't say it's a man, can't say it's a woman. It's just a thing or person, as is often said, is a way to get around that. But even person is problematic because it has the word son in it, which is a man. It's just ridiculous. But I mean, it fits with the whole rest of the ridiculousness of this ideology. It's detached from reality, and everybody knows it. But a lot of people are too afraid to speak up about it. And no, that's not transphobia. That's common sense. It's not quote-unquote transphobic to point out that there are real men and real women, and the binary really does exist, and all the hooping and hollering and tub thumping and chest beating and jumping up and down and throwing dust in the air can't change that. That's reality. So I just wanted you to know, and you know, if you haven't downloaded Aretha Franklin lately on Spotify, now might be a good time to get that song and play it. Play it regularly. Play it for your kids. I never thought I'd ever say that. 888-914-9149. Note here that came in from Michael listening in Los Angeles. He says, good morning, Patrick. Welcome back. Great to hear your voice again. Thank you. If I go to confession regularly and complete a thorough investigation of my sins, am I liable for those sins on the in-between visits to the confessional only, or are all the sins that I've committed since my childhood baptism to on the table for this exit interview? Okay, I think I understand. You're talking about not confession per se, but when you have the particular judgment, Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. Okay. Yes, insofar as that when you have your exit interview, when you are particularly judged by the Lord, it will cover your whole life. That's true. But the beauty part about that is that if you have been loving the Lord and following him and by his grace rising above and seeking to do what he asks you to do and receiving the sacraments and all of these things, it will be a happy occasion because the Lord will say to you, well done, good and faithful servant, for you have been faithful over a little. Now enter into the joy of your master. That's what he will say at the end of your exit interview if you die in the state of grace. Now, the converse is true. If you die in the state of mortal sin, you won't hear those words. It'll probably be something like, depart from me, you evildoer, for I never knew you. Or words to that effect. We don't want to hear those words, obviously. So keep doing what you're doing. Keep receiving the sacraments. Love Jesus. Trust in him for your salvation. Rely upon his grace. Cooperate with his grace. All the things that the Lord tells us in the four Gospels. Keep doing that. And when the day comes, your exit interview will be a happy occasion. We should all be praying for that, right? I have this note that came in from Elizabeth, and she's listening. Actually, I'm not going to read that one. I'll go to a different one. Here's one that comes in from, This is from Tony. He's listening on the Relevant Radio app. He says, I've returned to Mass, weekly Mass, after 25 years of only going on the High Holy Days, being inspired after watching a show on Blessed Father Solanus Casey and being filled by the Holy Spirit. Being fed now by Relevant Radio and your show, I went to confession this weekend after being away for 25 years. In my sin of pride and arrogance, I didn't see the need for this sacrament, but your show and reading the Act of Contrition inspired me to go back. It was a wonderful and fulfilling experience. Thank you and God bless. Thank you, Tony. Kind of you to take time from your busy day and share that with us. And what a tremendous victory in your life, 25 years away from the sacrament of confession. I must imagine that that felt so liberating for you. Let's go to Megan now in Colorado. Hi, Megan.
Hi. So I'm looking for some advice. We have an extended family member, a woman who's in a partnership with another woman, and we just found out that our family member is pregnant and plans to raise this baby with this other woman.
Okay.
And we just want to know,
is this an IVF baby?
We're not sure.
Okay.
We're not sure
because we know it wasn't from the other woman. We know that.
No. All we know is it was definitely outside the marital act. That's
okay.
We can know that for sure, but we don't know the circumstances, particularly of the child's conception. So we just want to know, how do we appreciate this life, but we don't also want to give the impression that we condone how the baby was conceived or, or the, the lifestyle in which this child's going to be raised.
Yeah, I understand. So I think you really almost answered the question in your asking of it, and that is that this is an innocent, beautiful child. We owe this child all the love and acceptance and nurturing that we would for any other child who comes into the world, let's say in an intact family, mom and dad. So this is an innocent little child, and he or she deserves all of those things from us. So in your interaction with the child, just love on that child and do everything you would if it were any other baby born into your family. There's no difference in God's eyes. Now, naturally, the occasion of the conception is problematic, and that's between God and the parents and the people involved, I guess. So in that, you don't have to worry that if you show love and affection and all the other natural things that every child deserves, regardless of how he or she was conceived, you don't have to worry that somehow that is condoning it. Even if the people involved might want to see it that way, you can remonstrate with them privately and say, you know, I love this child and I'm going to do everything I can to help with this child, but it doesn't mean that I agree with the way you went about doing this. You know, think of it, if I can put it in a much more dramatic and terrible analogy. Imagine if instead of this way of being conceived, imagine if the child had been conceived in rape. So when you stop and think about it, as you're loving that child and nurturing that child and welcoming that child and all the other things that we just talked about, obviously you're not condoning the way in which the child was conceived. It was a horrible thing that happened, and yet you still love this baby. So I would take that same approach. Love, 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 and at the same time, if it's appropriate or if there's an opportunity to do so, you could let the women know, you know, this doesn't mean I agree with you. It just means that God has given a gift in the midst of a situation that's not really very good. And see where that goes. Megan, I apologize. I ran out of time. See how much I talk? I talk and talk and talk, and we ran out of time.
We did wonder, like, practically, is like a baby gift or going to a baby shower okay?
Yeah, I would do it. Lavish that child with love.
Okay. All right.
Love, love, love. Thanks, Megan. I'm coming right back with hour three. Please don't go anywhere.